Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the January 29th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows the Oval Office, and it is a mess. One of the curtains is down. The flags are knocked over. One of the windows is broken. George Washington's picture is askew on the wall. There's stuff all over the floor, furniture broken. There's a Confederate flag. On the Oval Office desk is empty fast food wrappers and a empty Diet Coke can spilled. In the foreground, you see newly elected President Joe Biden, and he's got a dustpan and a broom, and he's sweeping up the mess and just kind of looking into the camera. The headline is Biden's Big Challenge: How the 46th President Will Try to Clean Up His Predecessor's Mess. And that is our first main story. Start right there. Asking for unity, Biden unveils ambitious agenda. What happened? Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. was sworn in as America's 46th president this week, pledging to bring civility and unity to a nation reeling from a deadly pandemic and deeply divided after four tumultuous years under Donald Trump. "This is our historic moment of crisis and challenge," he said. "Unity is the path forward." Kamala Harris was sworn in as vice president, the first woman and person of color to hold that position. After an insurrection that saw pro-Trump rioters storm the U.S. Capitol exactly 2 weeks earlier, the nation's seat of power was transformed into a veritable fortress, ringed by fences and patrolled by 25,000 National Guard members and hundreds of active-duty troops trained to handle chemical, biological, and explosive weapons. In place of a crowd, a sea of flags representing the more than 400,000 Americans killed in the pandemic filled the National Mall as Biden spoke of a need to end our uncivil war and restore the soul of America. "We can do this if we open our souls instead of hardening our hearts," he said. "Every disagreement doesn't have to be a cause for total war." Facing challenges greater than any new president since Franklin Roosevelt in 1933, Biden, 78, immediately began work on an aggressive agenda to combat the pandemic and reverse a long list of Trump policies. He planned to sign 17 executive orders, proclamations, and memorandums whose aims included rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement, halting border wall construction, and rescinding the rollbacks to vehicle emissions standards. He promised within days to send an immigration reform package to Congress that would ease the pathway to citizenship for millions. And he vowed to push for a passage of his $1.9 trillion pandemic stimulus plan, whose provisions include federal unemployment supplements, a round of household stimulus checks, state and local aid, rent assistance, and child care subsidies. What the editorial said: Biden takes office at an extraordinarily tense and uncertain moment in American history, said the Chicago Tribune. He faces a rampaging pandemic that's filling hospitals and cemeteries, a battered economy, and deep racial and political divisions. But he brings with him reasons for optimism. A man of voluminous experience, he's assembled a seasoned team and laid out thoughtful and detailed economic and pandemic plans. Instinctively empathetic, Biden is a sober realist who promises to neutralize some of the bitter animosity that has poisoned our politics during the Trump years. Every American should hope for his success. With most Americans craving an end to the furious rancor of recent years, the measured, bridge-building Biden could be the man for this moment, said the Wall Street Journal. But his success will depend on resisting the divisive progressive domination sought by his party's left. Buoyed by the Democratic media complex in Silicon Valley, the party's left wing aims to use the federal government as a battering ram to drive economic and cultural transformation. To succeed in healing divisions, Biden must tune them out and not use the rhetoric of crisis to pursue radical change. What the columnist said, Biden's pandemic stimulus plan is downright Rooseveltian, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. Like FDR, he's fighting an economic crisis by trying to address long-neglected problems of inequality. Poverty-fighting measures include food assistance, measures to prevent homelessness, and an expansion of the child tax credit that could cut child poverty by nearly half. In a nation that is struggling with hunger, disease, and broken communities, such bold action is thrilling to see. The stimulus bill is a Trojan horse for a sweeping liberal agenda, said Brad Palumbo in WashingtonExaminer.com. Supposedly focused on pandemic relief, it's larded with blatant partisan priorities like bailouts for badly managed blue states and a $15 minimum wage that would push small businesses past the brink and erase up to 3.7 million jobs. This is a massive expansion of the welfare state, not pandemic relief, and Republicans shouldn't feel guilty about voting against it. This is no time for moderation, said Robert Reich in The Guardian. Talk of governing from the center is meaningless at a time when the Republican Party resides in a counterfactual wonderland of lies and conspiracies. Instead, Biden must chart a bold course, advancing the needs of average people over the plutocrats and oligarchs, and embracing both racial justice and the struggle of blue-collar workers whose fortunes have been declining for decades. Biden could be a transformative president, said Seth Kotler in USA Today, but first he must overcome Americans' anti-government cynicism. The New Deal belief in the federal government as a positive force in Americans' lives hit a brick wall in the Reagan years, but after suffering through a pandemic worsened by federal inaction and ineptitude, the public may be ready for a more proactive federal government. Controversy of the week. Trump, the worst president ever? We will be back in some form. Have a good life. With that melancholy farewell delivered to a modest group of supporters, President Donald J. Trump this week turned and boarded Air Force One for the final time, said Philip Rucker in the Washington Post. A president once omnipresent in American life, spent the last week of his single term effectively in hiding, reportedly brooding over imagined injustices, and insistently repeating the big lie that November's presidential election was stolen from him. With his Twitter feed permanently suspended, Trump's petulance found an outlet in a series of petty snubs to the incoming president. Trump not only skipped Joe Biden's inauguration, he refused to even use his name in a scripted farewell address. Fittingly, he issued a final raft of 143 presidential pardons to fraudsters, corrupt politicians, and cronies such as Steve Bannon, the architect of Trump's unlikely rise to power. Trump's graceless departure was like that of a failed coup leader in a banana republic who has negotiated his exile but leaves at the point of a bayonet, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. Facing a second impeachment trial, this one for inciting an insurrection, The 45th president flew out over a national capital bristling with barricades and 25,000 National Guard troops protecting his successor. Clearly, Trump was the worst president in the 232-year history of the United States, said historian Tim Naftali in TheAtlantic.com. He was worse than Richard Nixon, worse even than Warren Harding, James Buchanan, and Andrew Johnson. Before he was elected, Trump welcomed and amplified a Russian disinformation plot against his opponent. In office, he shamelessly abused his power to enrich himself and to ensure his reelection. His ham-fisted extortion of Ukraine's president led to his first impeachment. Through denialism and sheer incompetence, he so horribly mismanaged the pandemic response that the U.S. has by far the most cases and deaths in the world. And when he lost in November, Trump mounted the first effort by a defeated incumbent to overturn a fair election, inciting an assault on Congress that nearly got his vice president and many legislators killed. Trump appealed to America's ugliest impulses, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. He leaves the country filled with misery and despair, and with our divisions seeming more intractable than ever. Before his disastrous end, Trump did have a remarkable set of accomplishments, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. His judicial appointments put a conservative stamp on federal courts that will last for decades. He curbed illegal immigration. With tax cuts and deregulation, he boosted the U.S. economy. Trump's lasting legacy, though, will be the political mobilization of America's tens of millions of forgotten men and women, said David Bonson in NationalReview.com. The conservative movement needs to find leaders who can fight for the working class's interest with Trump's energy, force, and boldness, yet without his self-defeating traits of ego and childishness. If the GOP is to have a future, said Rick Wilson in TheDailyBeast.com, it first needs a reckoning for those who empowered, enabled, and normalized that grotesque man for four wretched years. At the end, many Republicans joined Trump in dragging the nation to the edge of a conspiracy-driven insurrection that would have ended our democracy. Unless Republicans tell the truth about who Trump was and what he did, my old party will either be taken over by QAnon lunatics or go the way of the Whigs. In our good week, bad week segment, it was a good week for pandemic relief after a Tennessee law firm announced it would celebrate Valentine's Day by offering a free divorce to whoever submits the best rationale. After we've endured the coronavirus pandemic, explained paralegal Timothy Sexton, some people may have reached their breaking point. It was a good week for speaking truth to father. After James Murdoch, son of Fox News owner Rupert Murdoch, said he hoped the Capitol insurrection would persuade certain media property owners to repudiate the toxic politics they have promoted. It was a good week for specimens, with the discovery by British paleontologists of the first fully preserved dinosaur anus. It does look a bit like the back opening on a crocodile, said researcher Jacob Vinther, but shaped in its perfect, unique way. But it was a bad week for cancel culture after the Michigan Republican Party sought to replace Republican Election Board official Aaron Van Langerveld, who cast the deciding vote to certify Joe Biden's victory in the state. My conscience is clear, said Van Langerveld. It was a bad week for goop, with a British woman's claim that one of Gwyneth Paltrow's famous vagina-scented candles exploded in her living room. There were bits flying everywhere, said Jody Thompson, age 50. We eventually got it under control and threw it out the front door. Finally, it was a bad week for the Republican Party, after the Wall Street Journal reported that the embittered former President Trump is discussing a possibility of starting a new political party for his loyal followers, which he may call the Patriot Party. Briefing page gets us away from politics for a moment. The title is Psychedelics as Therapy. Research shows that hallucinogens can be highly effective treatments for anxiety, depression, addiction, and trauma. Aren't psychedelic drugs illegal? Under federal and most states' laws, they are. But a push to legalize or decriminalize the drugs is gaining momentum. On Election Day, Oregon voters made their state the first to legalize the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, psilocybin, for mental health therapy in a controlled setting with a therapist. Washington, D.C. voters passed Initiative 81, making the city at least the fifth to decriminalize magic mushrooms. Similar legislation has been proposed in California, Vermont, and Iowa. Last summer, Canada issued 4 terminally ill patients exemptions to take psilocybin for end-of-life anxiety and depression. British Columbia resident Mona Streloff, 67, got an exemption for treatment for trauma, addiction, depression, and anxiety. All the unresolved trauma, Streloff said, it came back and I was beyond terrified, shaking uncontrollably and crying. She said that psilocybin therapy helped her conquer those tough memories, and today she ain't afraid of Jack Blank. How does psychedelic therapy work? Participants usually take psilocybin or LSD in a relaxing setting, lying down with blindfolds and headphones on, listening to music. Trained supervisors encourage them to go inward and to a kind of experience whatever is going to come up, said Alan Davis, who studies psychedelics at Johns Hopkins University. Bad psilocybin trips are rare. Johns Hopkins and NYU researchers conducted 500 sessions without observing any serious adverse effects, but they can occur. Advocates say careful dose control, supervision, and controlled settings are very important. Psilocybin sessions typically last between 4 and 6 hours, while LSD sessions go on for 12. Robert Carhart Harris, who runs the Center for Psychedelic Research at Imperial College in London, theorized that such sessions can reboot the brain in a way similar to a near-death or intense spiritual experience. What's the neuroscience? Psychedelics have been shown to stimulate new brain cell growth and create more complex connections that enable various far-flung areas of the brain to communicate with one another. Habitual rigid patterns of thinking are broken. At the same time, these drugs temporarily dissolve the ego, the sense of separation of the self from everything else, and produce an oceanic feeling of oneness with the universe, which is why many indigenous societies have used them in spiritual practices. I didn't know where I ended and my surroundings began, one patient told Michael Pollan, author of a book on psychedelic therapy, How to Change Your Mind. Why does the ego disappear? Experiments have shown that psychedelics diminish blood flow and oxygen consumption in an area of the brain called the default mode network, or DMN. The DMN, which scientists have nicknamed the ME network, acts as a gatekeeper for consciousness, filtering out information so that the brain can operate more efficiently. As the DMN gets turned off, people experience a sudden opening of the gates of perception, ideas, and visions, with vivid hallucinations that give participants new insights into themselves and into life itself. What are the benefits? Researchers say they can be profound and wide-ranging. One 2014 Johns Hopkins study found that 80% of smokers who underwent psilocybin-assisted therapy reported that they remained smoke-free 6 months afterward. The universe was so great, and there were so many things you could do and see in it, that killing yourself seemed like a dumb idea, one smoker told Pollen. A 2016 study reported that 83% of cancer patients with depression and anxiety enjoyed profound increases in life satisfaction or well-being from a single psilocybin dose. About two-thirds of study participants ranked the therapy among the top five spiritually significant events in their lives. One professed atheist recalled feeling bathed in God's love. Fear of death often disappears. Why are these drugs illegal? During the 1950s, some psychologists thought psychedelics could revolutionize mental health treatment. But when recreational use of these powerful substances became popular among hippies in the 1960s, it sparked a backlash, with tales of bad trips and psychotic breaks. In 1965, the federal government banned psychedelic drugs, and the company stopped producing them for research. Timothy Leary, the rebel psychologist who encouraged youngsters to turn on, tune in, and drop out, was branded the most dangerous man in America by President Nixon. But after decades of underground use, research into their value has experienced a renaissance. In 2018, the FDA designated psilocybin as a breakthrough therapy for depression and anxiety. A year later, Johns Hopkins University launched the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research, the same year that Imperial College in London launched its center. The hoary 60s platitude that psychedelics would help unlock the secret of consciousness, Pollen says, may turn out not to be so preposterous after all. Time to read a few of the best columns. We'll start with one titled Executing Mentally Ill Prisoners. On the way out the door, the Trump administration went on a spree of lame duck executions of chilling injustice and inhumanity, said Austin Surratt. The administration killed three federal prisoners last week alone, for a total of 13 since July. Triple the number of federal executions over the past six decades. The overwhelming majority of state-sanctioned killings are of people suffering from intellectual disabilities, severe mental illness, and/or a disabling history of childhood abuse and trauma. Consider Lisa Montgomery, executed this month. She was gang-raped at 11 by her stepfather and his friends, brain-damaged by severe beatings, and trafficked by her mother to pay bills. She was delusional throughout her life. Executed prisoner Daniel Lewis Lee also suffered severe childhood abuse that left him mentally ill. Wesley Perkey, executed in July, was sexually abused by his mother and had schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Judges and juries often discounted the roles of severe childhood abuse and mental illness in serious criminal behavior, viewing disturbed and delusional people as more dangerous and deserving of execution. It's unconscionable, and it's one more reason President Biden should end the federal death penalty and lead a campaign for nationwide abolition of capital punishment. The tragic shortage of good masks. Why aren't we wearing better masks? Asked Zeynep Tufekci and Jeremy Howard. In the early days of the pandemic, Americans began wearing cloth masks to reduce the chances they would spread or be infected with coronavirus. At the same time, there was a dire shortage of N95 and other high-grade masks, so those were reserved for healthcare workers. but not all masks are equal. While cloth masks are effective in blocking exhaled droplets and in reducing overall transmission rates, they lack the tight fit and highly protective filters of medical-grade masks. U.S.-made N95s and KN95s from China screen out 95% of tiny virus-carrying droplets called aerosols, and thus provide strong protection to the wearer. At the start of the pandemic, Taiwan, Singapore, and Hong Kong all vastly scaled up their manufacture of medical-grade masks and have been distributing them to everyone. Not incidentally, Taiwan's COVID-19 per capita death rate is 1,000 times lower than the U.S.'s. Tragically, the Trump administration made no effort to produce high-filtration masks for the general public. The Biden administration should provide simple, clear, actionable, and specific information about masks and make medical-grade masks easy to get. This is a column from Canada. Police will choose whom to punish. The U.S. isn't the only country struggling with white supremacy and tone-deaf politicians, said Sri Parakhtar. Here in Canada, we too had a summer of reckoning of anti-black racism. There were calls to reallocate police funding, and 39% of Canadians agreed there was a serious problem with the way police interact with black, indigenous, and other non-white people. At the time, Ontario Premier Doug Ford said that he stood by his black constituents. But last week, he drastically scaled up police powers by declaring a new COVID lockdown that will be enforced by the cops. For the next month, anyone who leaves home for a non-essential activity can be fined thousands of dollars or face up to a year in prison. But Ford refused to get specific about what could get people into trouble. Home Depot is open, so does buying plant seed count as essential? The vagueness of these rules places tremendous power in the hands of police. Academics have already documented how Canadians of color are being disproportionately targeted and fined for COVID-related offenses. Dark-skinned Canadians are scared not of the white supremacist, anti-democratic mobs that black Americans fear, but a different form of white supremacy, our own police. It's time for the last word, our in-depth feature article. Title this week, Wrestling with the Darkness. The pandemic year has been especially difficult for those of us who suffer from depression, trauma, and anxiety, said Jeff Van Dyke in 5280 magazine. This is how it feels and how I push through. The darkness comes at night or in the morning or sometimes the late afternoon. In that liminal time between daytime and nighttime. It doesn't discriminate. It doesn't care that I have work to finish or that I should wash the dishes or that I need to check in on how my two boys' distance learning work is going. It doesn't care that after 7 months of mostly staying at home, I have already been examining the uglier recesses of my psyche. It comes fast and hard, and it's nearly impossible to explain to someone who hasn't experienced the weight of anxiety and depression, but I will try. If you imagine the excitement, anticipation, and joy of a forthcoming event, seeing a loved one, going to a concert, a day of skiing or snowboarding in powder, and then you invert that feeling, you will have some idea of what the experience is like, for me at least. Rather than butterflies in your stomach and a hit of dopamine or endorphins, it feels like a shroud has been dropped over your senses. Sometimes there's a triggering event, a conflict at home, a challenging day at work, an unsettling segment on the evening news. Sometimes there's not. Sometimes when I wake up, It's just there. When it's really bad, the colors in my field of vision dim. I frequently notice the desaturation of the world when I'm driving to work. When we used to do that kind of thing, to get to my office in Denver's Lodo, I drive up Spear Boulevard from my neighborhood, south of downtown, and it's as though everything outside the windshield is dulled. The colors all run together in muted shades, as if a child blended his paints a little too carelessly. Nothing seems to cut through the gray. A favorite song, a funny podcast, a friend checking in to ask if I'm okay. None of it helps. My mood disorder is such that I sometimes think of it as a predator waiting to attack. It is not always seen or felt, but it always there lurking. I know when it comes for me, it will hurt, and there is no remedy for the pain. So I wait. I wait for it to pass, and once it does, I wait until it comes along again. For those who haven't experienced clinical depression before, 2020 and its laundry list of awfulness seems almost flawlessly designed to make someone feel depressed and anxious. Psychological trauma is considered a leading cause of depression, and this year has delivered its share of collective traumas, from COVID-19 to widespread social unrest to wildfires burning throughout the western United States. I've been reminded of this repeatedly since mid-March, when normally upbeat friends said, okay, when I ask how they're doing, or when other friends who haven't been diagnosed with depression say that, in fact, they feel depressed. A May Washington Post article cites Census Bureau data indicating that one-third of all Americans are experiencing symptoms of depression or anxiety. A United Nations policy memo suggested this past spring that a long-term upsurge in the number and severity of mental health problems is likely as a result of the pandemic. And a September Wired article reported that experts fear the difficulties surrounding COVID-19 will add up to a second pandemic of mental illness. It shouldn't come as a surprise that many of us have turned to a particular and widely accepted coping mechanism, alcohol. Not long after Denver Mayor Michael Hancock announced that liquor stores would close to help slow the spread of the novel coronavirus, lines formed outside the shops so people could stock up on one of society's greatest numbing agents. I didn't need to get in line. My bar cart was stocked, and my basement beer fridge was full. They usually are. For years, along with my daily dose of 50 milligrams of Zoloft, I've used alcohol as an anxiolytic, as a way to ease my discomfort with certain social situations and to dull the stress that comes with everyday living. My relationship with booze was already fraught, something I've discussed with three different therapists over the years, and the stay-at-home orders only served to exacerbate a long simmering problem. Freed from the responsibility of having to drive my boys to school at 7 a.m. most mornings, I rationalized that there was no issue with having a few extra drinks on a weeknight. If I felt fuzzy in the morning, I'd flip open my laptop by 9:30, and no one would know. If there were ever an acceptable reason to cut myself some slack, I told myself, it was a global pandemic. Turns out I gave myself a little too much latitude. I drink because I was depressed about the pandemic and the tragedies resulting from it, and because I was anxious about work and any number of other things. The following morning, I'd have a headache and have to face the shame of having lost control with alcohol yet again. By early afternoon, my mind would clear and the regret would subside, but that made headspace for the depression and anxiety to return. It also left room for the voice that tells me the reason my company is struggling is because I suck at my job, that the reason I've put on 10 pounds is because I'm lazy and drink too much, that the reason my kids are bored is because I'm a crappy dad. After listening to the voice berate me for a few hours, 5 o'clock would once again bring relief. I'd crack a beer or mix a margarita, lather, rinse, repeat. For people suffering through the despondency spurred by the pandemic or social unrest or the election of natural disasters, the pain is real. If it's anything like my first encounter with depression, it's also probably wildly confusing and terribly frightening. For those who are already familiar with melancholia, though, 2020 has delivered a unique blow. A May 2020 article in The Atlantic quotes Andrew Solomon, author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, on what some of us who have mood disorders have been experiencing this year. People already diagnosed with a major depressive disorder develop what some clinicians call double depression, in which the underlying disorder coexists with a new layer of fear and sorrow. Depression is bad. Double depression is really awful. This is what it has looked like for me. Over the past half year, I've been pushed into profound misery for roughly 48 to 72 hours at least once a week. I don't smile. I don't laugh. I have difficulty feeling love. I contemplate different ways of hurting myself. I want to sleep so I don't have to think about anything anymore. Sometimes I work the better part of the day and then crawl into bed at 4:30 in the afternoon and sleep for 2 hours. Then, of course, I can't fall asleep at night. My mood darkens. My mind whirs. The voice remains. I once did an exercise with my therapist called a trauma timeline. Everybody experiences trauma differently, no matter how minor or major it might seem to others. And the trauma timeline is designed to identify how and when the client experiences it. In doing this assignment, I learned depression, or something approaching depression, had been near to me for years. I believe it was there when, after each semester in college ended, I would fall into a funk. And I believe it was there when my girlfriend, now my wife, and I split up for a few months in our late 20s, and I thought my life was over. These kinds of things are not at all rare for anyone. They are not disastrous traumas or life-destroying events, and for people without mood disorders, they would not be treated as such. For someone who struggles with depression and anxiety, however, they take on an outsized importance, both in real time and in that person's history. I have actually lived a very fortunate life, but I have experienced events that one might consider classic depression inducers, things that could send almost anyone into a period of sustained melancholy. Strangely, these did not do that for me. My dad has beaten cancer twice. My mom has painful osteoarthritic issues for which she's had numerous surgeries. My eldest son was born by an emergency C-section after my wife suffered a placental abruption during labor. Perhaps most significantly, though, my younger brother was diagnosed with a rare and potentially deadly form of leukemia when he was 26. To this day, I'm not sure why those ordeals didn't drive me into abject sadness. I didn't feel the shroud of depression lower itself over my senses. The voice that so often tells me I'm not good enough, that I'm a failure, that I don't fit in, that I create rather than solve problems, that I am a blanking idiot, never appeared. This disease doesn't lend itself to easy answers, but I have wondered if each occasion involved a component of good stress that allowed me to be proactive and productive. Myriad studies explain that some varieties of stress are deleterious. However, it is well known that a certain amount of stress can lead to adaptation. Maybe that's as good an explanation as any. Maybe I never felt despondent because, whether it was true or not, I felt like I could do something to help someone I was close to and loved deeply. On the other hand, a global pandemic, a national reckoning on systemic racism, raging wildfires, each of these issues feels overwhelming, scary, impossible to fix. Each thing on its own is so massive and disorienting that it's difficult to find even the smallest way to engage in a meaningful, substantive way. I haven't known what to do. It doesn't seem like anyone really knows what to do. It's all totally, completely paralyzing. Depression is the flaw in love. This is the opening line in Solomon's The Noonday Demon, and is perhaps the most succinct, accurate description of the disease I've ever read. To be creatures who love, we must be creatures who can despair at what we lose, and depression is the mechanism of that despair. What we have all lost over the past 11 months is immeasurable. What we have each lost is singular, difficult, and real. We are all struggling. We are all suffering. I started writing this piece in May for myself with no intention of publishing it. I was in a bad spot, and as so many writers know, writing can be therapeutic. Writing is also an act of discovery, and I have discovered much over the past few months as I've wrestled with my mood disorder and with the words on the page. Maybe my greatest revelation has been waking up to the fact that I do want to live, that my thoughts of hurting myself are fleeting, that I have the ability to quiet the voice when it arrives, sometimes through talk therapy, sometimes, yes, with the help of alcohol, and sometimes through the simple passage of time. I have also discovered that although the idea of telling my story makes me nervous, there is a relief in making my history with depression known. Of course, there is also the hope that this confession will make someone feel less isolated. Now, during what is arguably one of the most tumultuous, uncertain, and depression-inducing times in history, or later, when the pain of depression might come for no reason at all. Beyond that, what I know for sure is that I have much more to endure. In the meantime, I will continue to push forward, even as I wait for the darkness to come again. A version of this article originally appeared in 5280 magazine. Here's a couple of pieces from the health and science page. We'll start with evidence of a long-lasting COVID community, or excuse me, immunity. Most people who survive COVID-19 retain a robust immune response to the disease for at least 8 months, and potentially much longer, a new study has found. Since the start of the pandemic, there have been isolated reports of people being reinfected with the coronavirus. But a new study of blood samples from 188 COVID patients suggests that about 90% of people who recover from the disease retain stable immunity. This is in part because antibodies aren't the only weapon in the immune system's arsenal. The samples revealed what T cells and other defensive elements were ready to pounce on the virus if it reappeared. Because the immune system targets hundreds of different parts of the virus, the findings should apply to the new, more transmissible coronavirus variants that first appeared in the UK and South Africa. There's a lot of different arms of the immune system recognizing the virus, co-author Daniela Weisskopf from the Lajella Institute for Immunology tells the Washington Post. If you have a mutation, it wouldn't evade all of these different arms. The researchers believe immunity likely lasts longer than 8 months, because at the time of the study, it had shown no signs of decay. They are unsure why 10% of people see their immune response degrade. Given that uncertainty, said co-author Alessandro Sett, if I'd had COVID, I would still not throw away my masks. Apathy, a sign of dementia? Apathy in middle age could be a predictor for some forms of dementia, reports ScienceDaily.com. While easily mistaken for laziness or depression, a loss of motivation and interest in life has long been associated with front frontotemporal dementia, an often genetic condition that is typically diagnosed between the ages of 45 and 65. Researchers at Cambridge University for several years tracked 304 healthy people who carried the gene that causes frontotemporal dementia, and 296 of their relatives who did not. None began with dementia. The researchers looked for signs of apathy and conducted memory tests and brain scans. People with the gene were more apathetic than family members without. Their apathy grew as time went on and proved a predictor for cognitive decline. MRI scans showed brain shrinkage in areas supporting motivation and initiative. Treating dementia is a challenge, said Senior Arthur James Rowe, but the sooner we can diagnose the disease, the greater our window of opportunity to try to intervene and slow or stop its progress. And this is an article on the technology page. Parler, P-A-R-L-E-R, a Twitter alternative gets shut down. When Twitter and Facebook banned Donald Trump and cracked down on conspiracy theories, Parler was supposed to be the social network to step into the void, said Gilead Edelman in Wired.com. It had, after all, billed itself as a free speech paradise, a haven for conservative users who believe big tech is out to silence them. But it turned out there was no haven from big tech after all. Not only did Apple and Google kick Parler out of their app stores, last week Amazon cut off Parler's access to its web services. That meant Parler vanished from the internet, said Joseph Min in Reuters.com. It has partially returned with only a bare-bones website hosted by a Russian company that has worked with racist, far-right, and conspiracy sites. Apple, Google, and Amazon say Parler didn't do enough to moderate its content, said Rachel Bovard in Newsweek.com. This is rich, coming from the companies that have never had a problem with Facebook and Twitter. Last year, representatives of the major tech companies sat on a stage at a Department of Justice workshop and insisted that what circulates on social media isn't their responsibility. They said, if you don't like the existing social media companies, go ahead and build your own. It turns out that was really nothing more than a slogan or a rationalization. Amazon was well within its rights to boot the right-wing social network Parler off its cloud service, said Jonah Goldberg in thedispatch.com. Parler was used by jackasses to foment violence and hatred in the days leading up to the riot at the U.S. Capitol. The First Amendment, like the rest of the Bill of Rights, constrains what the federal government can do. But it also gives the right and obligation to private institutions and even some public ones to say, we want no part of this behavior. Parler is now suing Amazon for forcing its website to go dark, but that suit is bound to fail, just as any restaurant can say, no shirt, no shoes, no service. Amazon can say, no calls for civil war or genocide. If it's really that simple, it's strange that even Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey has second thoughts, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. We rarely find ourselves on the same side as him on speech controls, but we give him credit for at least reflecting on his decisions in the new world the tech titans are creating. In a series of Twitter posts, Dorsey said that his company always told users they can go to another internet service, but that principle is challenged if companies like Amazon won't host what they find dangerous. Continuing down this path means erosion of a free and open internet. And as we often do, we will finish out the show on the Talking Points page. Got an article for you here titled Capitol Hill Riot, Violent Extremists from the Middle Class. Lawyers, doctors, nurses, realtors, firefighters, current and former members of the military more than two dozen police officers, a woman in a Louis Vuitton sweater, a CEO of data analytics firm, and numerous prosperous business owners, even a state legislator. All were among the hundreds of Americans who invaded and sacked the U.S. Capitol last week in a violent insurrection that killed a Capitol police officer and left four others dead. It's an uncomfortable truth for white America to acknowledge. The mob that terrorized Congress is in support of a white supremacist agenda was not limited to neo-Nazis and toothless rednecks. In the Trump era, people who deeply believe in conspiracy theories and would happily overturn an election are indistinguishable from the rest of us. Indeed, a YouGov poll found that 45% of Republicans approved of the assault on the Capitol. We all saw the images of bearded, tattooed men from Dog Patch and bare-chested nuts wearing animal skin, said Jack Schaefer in Politico.com. But many of the rioters, we now know after their arrest, are solidly middle class and were drawn from the Republican professional and political classes. Dismissing them as a bunch of delusional barbarians only increases the great difficulty we will have in nullifying their violent brand of politics. There were definitely some hardened extremists in the crowd, said Devlin Barrett and Spencer Tzu in the Washington Post. Dozens of people on a terrorist watch list came to Washington, D.C. that day, and the FBI is investigating the roles of violent right-wing groups like the Proud Boys, Three Percenters, and Oath Keepers. Prosecutors charged Robert Gieswein, 24, an alleged member of the Three Percenters from Colorado, with breaching the Capitol in a military vest and goggles, brandishing a baseball bat, and fighting with police. Guy Reffitt, a Texan and alleged member of the militia group Texas Freedom Force, allegedly joined the riot and threatened to shoot his children if they became traitors and turned him in. These organized domestic terrorists may have planned and led the actual assault on the building, with hundreds of MAGA fans then joining in. The FBI has arrested dozens of accused rioters and says it's seeking more than 200. Charges may include seditious conspiracy, which carries a potential 20-year prison sentence. Many Christians have been shaken to the core by what they saw that day, said David Brooks in the New York Times. Some evangelicals caught up in Trump fanaticism blasted Christian pop music as they took over the Capitol, kneeled in prayer after sacking the House chamber, and chanted, "Hang Mike Pence." After the riot, a shocked conservative preacher, Jeremiah Johnson, apologized for having supported Trump. He said he was then barraged with thousands of emails from fellow Christians saying the nastiest and most vulgar things I have ever heard. Most evangelicals are from the South, said David French in the Dispatch.com, and what's driving their Trumpist rage is the Southern shame-slash-honor culture that dates back to the Confederacy. These people deeply believe Trump's demagogic warning that they're losing their country to secular urban progressives. Their desperate fury and culture of grievance is poisoning both evangelical Christianity and the Republican Party. Indeed, vast majorities of Republicans still support Trump, even after an insurrection he clearly incited, said Mike Allen and Margaret Talib in Axios.com. A poll taken after the Capitol siege found that 64% of Republicans support Trump's recent behavior, and 57% of Republicans think he should be his party's presidential candidate in 2024. While 10 House Republicans voted for impeachment, 93% of the Republican colleagues didn't. Many Republicans fear that convicting Trump in the Senate would only make him a martyr and further cement his hold on millions of people. Even after last week's debacle, it's still Trump's party. The GOP faces a choice, said Republican Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska in TheAtlantic.com. We can repudiate the nonsense that has set our party on fire, or we can be a party of conspiracy theories, cable news fantasies, and the ruin that comes with them. Many of the insurrectionists believe the QAnon conspiracy theory that there is a network of cannibalistic pedophiles supported by deep state intelligence officials and senators like me. Among QAnon's ranks is Marjorie Taylor Greene, a cuckoo freshman House member from Georgia. Last fall, the GOP could have decided to disavow her campaign and potentially lose a Republican seat, but instead decided to bless Greene's ludicrous ideas. In coming months, we must choose whether to side with reality or with deranged, violent thinking. We cannot do both. Time for one short note. We'll go with the federal government ran a $3.3 trillion budget deficit during the 2020 calendar year, triple the amount from 2019. At the end of 2020, the gross national debt stood at $27.5 trillion, nearly $7.8 trillion higher than when former President Trump was sworn in. And we'll finish with a quote from Seamus Haney, who says, "If we winter this one out, we can summer anywhere." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.